Plymouth Rock is one of America's prominent icons. Associated with the most hallowed of our European settlers, the Pilgrims, it is visited by thousands of tourists each year. We celebrate the Rock as well as the Pilgrims this week in our annual Thanksgiving celebration. What better time to re-examine Plymouth Rock's place in history? Here to help us do that is Robert Arner, professor of English at the University of Cincinnati. Professor Arner is the author of Plymouth Rock Revisited, The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers, which appeared in the Journal of American Culture. Welcome, Professor Arner.
Thank you very much.
Right. Just to get us up to speed, very briefly, if you could you summarize the story of the Pilgrims for us?
Well, sure. They were a very small dissenting group of intensely religious people. Who believed that the Church of England had overstepped the ritual and symbol and ornamentation of true religious worship, and that there really wasn't that much to choose between the supposedly Protestant Church of England and the Catholic Church of Rome, which they despised. They also didn't agree with the hierarchy, the bishops and archbishops and so on. In their reading of the Bible, the original brotherhood at the Last Supper was the model for the true church. And so they they shared that view, that anti-establishment view, with another group, which we know as the Puritans, but they were more radical in voicing it and actually declared themselves separate from the Church of England, which the Puritans were not to do for a very long time, and not till they were safely in America. And so they were persecuted and prevented from leaving, although eventually they did go to Holland, where they lived for about 20 years. Holland at that time was very hospitable to radical Protestantism, and especially anti-English radical Protestantism. But then they decided, because they were losing the language and their children were intermarrying and so on, that they wanted to go somewhere where nobody could intrude upon their solidarity. And so they settled somewhat reluctantly on this barbarous land of the wilds of America. And as every schoolchild knows, or used to know, they arrived in what is now the town of Plymouth in 1620.
Okay, well, how does Plymouth Rock figure into this story of religious dissenters?
Well, it didn't. Not as far as any of the original sources are concerned, which are really two, Mort's Relation and then deriving from that or having been used by the same basic document used, was Governor William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation. And there's no mention of landing on a rock or anything like that. That all came later. And you can be pretty certain, if they had used it, that given their mindset, which was to look for symbols in everything, signs of God's approval or displeasure, that they would probably have found something to say about it.
All right. So, what is the first historical reference that we have to the rock?
Well, it doesn't really show up until the 1740s, about a century and a couple of decades after the so-called first landing, which was actually the second or third landing too, as far as that goes. But that's another story. In any case, it shows up as a boundary marker on a map of the town at the sea's edge. And also about that time, an elder of the Pilgrim Church, a man named Ephraim Spooner, who was then in his 90s, as the town was planning to build a wharf and remove the rock, came forth, had himself actually carried to the spot in a litter chair, and identified that rock as the place where the Pilgrims had first set foot, the first American piece of real estate, as it were. And Spooner had been a child when some of the original founding Pilgrim fathers like John Alden and Miles Standish were around, so people took that as gospel. But in a sense, everything about the rock since then rests on this man's frail memory.
Well, if it takes over a century just to have record of the rock, when did we actually start commemorating the Pilgrim landing?
Well, the Pilgrims began to be commemorated in the 1760s and early 1770s as part of First Landing Day. This was the brainchild of a group of people called the Old Colony Club, which was established mainly as a way of, you know, descendants of the first comers of providing themselves with a kind of social barrier between their class and the latecomers, the illegitimate new settlers. But the club was also modeled on other clubs in the colonies and featured speeches and papers, and people wrote poems and stuff like that, presentations. So there's going to be, there is an article coming out on that, but unfortunately it's coming out and I haven't seen it, by David Shields, who is an excellent scholar of this sort of thing.
Oh, we'll look for it.
Yes, I will too.
Okay. It took 150 years, you're saying, before they even began to recognize the landing in any way.
I would say, yeah, that's a good figure to...
And that also puts us in the era of the American Revolution.
That's
Is there any
right.
connection there?
Well, that's not coincidental. You know, people were looking for ways to distinguish or validate their claims either as children of England or as sons of liberty. And so there was from the first in the old colony club membership made up of both of those factions, and it was the patriots who first saw the value of claiming the stone as an object of veneration for civil libertarians, and so they endowed it with a political dimension that it didn't, of course, have, even if Mr. Stoner, or Spooner rather, was right in identifying it to begin with.
So the patriots seize upon the rock to make it a patriotic symbol of the revolution at the same time that they tie it to the Pilgrim Landing.
That's right. They actually proposed to lift it from where it was, move it out of the seashore and move it to the town square and place it next to the Liberty Pole, which was, of course, indisputably a symbol of civil liberties and rebellion against the crown and so on. And when they did that, the rock broke. So they took the top part, the larger part, left the other part in the hole, and did in fact move it into the town and used it as a symbol of the revolution.
Well, as long as you're heading in that direction, you give a wonderful account of the constant moving of the rock in your article. Why don't you just complete it till we get it back at its current site again?
Well, then in 1820, with the 200th anniversary, there was a realization that maybe it should be rejoined to its original parts, and so it was also diminishing under the hands of tourists who kept chipping off pieces of it. And so the movement, I'm actually forgetting now whether this took place in 1820 or 1870 for the 250th. But in any case, they put it back on a cart, and it fell off and broke again. And so they took the two pieces and put them back in the hole with the original piece, cemented them together, put a brown marble canopy over them, which makes it 1870, and protected it from tourists and gave it a shrine, a kind of chapel, as it were. That itself would be changed in the 1920s. For the 300th anniversary, when they replaced that with a neo-classic structure designed by McKim, Mead, and White.
Well, let me ask you, it's a bit puzzling. You've got a group that they were not the first European settlers in America, not even the first English settlers in America. And as you just indicated, the rock didn't seem to play any particular major role in this. How did Plymouth Rock, or for that matter, even the Pilgrims, manage to catch Americans' imagination?
Well, I think there are a number of explanations for that, actually. And I might start with the Civil War. New England was on the winning side. And so the other competing claims, which were of Jamestown, obviously, here before Plymouth, were kind of discredited as belonging to a view of American society, which, was anti-democratic or various things that might have been said about it. But in fact, New England also, as the even before then, produced historians, and historians who wrote the histories concentrated naturally on their home states. People like Jedediah Morse, who was from Connecticut, but who could venerate a tradition as well as anybody, Myth of the Fathers. So I think it was a combination of Harvard-educated and Yale-educated historians, but especially Harvard-educated historians, controlling for the first few decades or even maybe first century of American history, controlling the press pretty much of the nation, and being committed to good promotions. You know, it was pretty much like today. I mean, it was they were quite serious about it, but it it had established itself as a tourist attraction, really by you know, the 1830s.
Not to make light of it, but what you're suggesting here is that if the South had won the Civil War, and if they had had more prominent historians, perhaps out of the University of Virginia or William and Mary, then we might have been celebrating the first landing at Jamestown in Jamestown Rock or something along that line.
Well, I think, you know, that may be stretching the case because there isn't one as far as I know. It being a marshy area, you know, and of course the rock is as a symbol that way is so well adapted to the myth of the rugged New Englander too. You know, it seems such a feature of an imposing and not particularly hospitable landscape, which had to be tamed and so on and so forth. But yes, I mean, I think that that had a lot to do with it. If there had been you know, established educational institutions other than William and Mary, if the South hadn't been educating its kids largely back in England, you know, it could have faded. It could have remained nothing but. The same thing is true of Thanksgiving. I mean, it could have remained pretty much a local celebration and not spread to the rest of the country.
But both the Rock and Thanksgiving did become national, and they remained quite popular for over a century. Why do you think that is? Again, what is it about Thanksgiving, the Pilgrims, the Rock, that maintains that level of interest?
Well, that's also a difficult question to answer. Thanksgiving, you know, was a harvest festival, I think, plain and simple, and an English custom to celebrate the harvest, which the Pilgrims quite naturally brought with them. It wasn't mythologized. The descendants of the Pilgrims at first picked it up as an alternative to Christmas, which they really distrusted and didn't want to celebrate as a pagan holiday or whatever. And so, you know, it's, again, in the late 18th and early 19th century, lots of shops and stores and so on already having special sales of imported sweet raisins and so on, which they are tying to, you know, great for Thanksgiving sort of thing. But it really wasn't until after the Civil War when members of Lincoln's cabinet, and they were all of them New Englanders, you know, worked to get this institutionalized as a national celebration. So, you know, the two, I don't know that you could say there's a very simple direct tie, but there certainly is an associational tie with the war between the states, if not to offend any Southern listeners.
Well, and certainly not to offend another interested party, the other group that would dissent in the popularity here and on whom we've spent considerable time in past programs would be the Native Americans, who certainly don't see Thanksgiving
right.
In quite the same way.
That's right. In fact, I like Stan Freeberg's take on that from an old album he made in the late 50s, The United States of America, where the wife of White Cloud, who is the owner of Manhattan Island, who is bugging him to sell Manhattan to white man so she can get lots of junk jewelry, says, "Why don't we live in Massachusetts? He got, like your brother, he got invited to lunch." And the Indian, of course, says, big deal.
That's great. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thank you very much for joining us, Professor Arner, and have a nice Thanksgiving.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to Robert Arner, Professor of English at the University of Cincinnati.